All right, guys. So, sorry. This is probably the most depressing portion of Judges. It's not quite as bad when you consider it in relation to the nature of God and some of the theological implications of this, these following verses. But yeah, it's gonna be a rough one as far as the depravity of Israel goes. But before we start, you guys join me in a word of prayer. All right. Lord, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the honesty of your word, and we thank you for what it reveals about yourself and what it reveals about us, Lord. I pray that you would really teach us tonight, Lord, that you would show us clearly your truth, and then you would soften our hearts to just wholeheartedly respond to that truth, Lord, because you are a good and gracious and merciful God, and we praise you for that, Lord. So I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so 17 and 18 would have really been kind of starting, you know, to expand out, right? We end our judges' narratives, or our deliverer narratives, back in 16 with Samson, right? Selfish Samson, right? Self-centered, lustful Samson, and he's kind of seeing this downward spiral in Israel throughout the course of this time period, and it's kind of reflected in the way that each one of these so-called deliverers seems to get worse, right? They're worse each time. And while the degrading, the moral degrading of Israel and the spiritual degrading of Israel is reflected in their judges over time, we can actually kind of see that that here, this next narrative we're going to read here, starting in chapter 19, probably actually occurs closer to the beginning, like the first quarter of the period of the judges. It's probably one of the most horrific accounts in the entire Bible. But yeah, it's brutal, but it actually is going to show us just how corrupt and depraved and Canaanized the people of Israel were throughout this entire period. Just because their judges kept getting worse, and we can kind of imply that the nation kept getting worse over the course of this period of two or three centuries, we're actually going to see that almost right from the outset, from the beginning, they had all but completely walked away from God and completely abandoned their covenant relationship with him, especially in certain regions. The reason that we actually can kind of make that sort of a conjecture is that there's this guy named Phinehas that shows up in chapter 20, I believe, and he would have been Aaron's grandson, right? Aaron, you know, Moses' brother. And so if you look at chronologically how long it would have taken to get from Aaron to Aaron's grandson, we can kind of, from there, we can kind of see that this is actually something that occurred closer to the beginning of the period of the judges, okay? So we're probably looking somewhere between maybe even just second judge, right? Like somewhere in that time frame, okay? So just because the judges have been getting worse over time, it seems like the nation was very evil and corrupt and depraved even from the beginning. This was no small apostasy that was taking place. This was no limited scope of sin. In fact, it was widespread, it was horrific, and it was evil right from the beginning, which should really start to make us kind of get a bigger picture of how merciful God was throughout this period, right? As we start to, we're going to be probably offended. We're probably going to be shocked. We're probably going to be a little bit horrified at times as we read this account. And then we're going to just have to consider for a moment, what kind of patience are we dealing with here? What kind of mercy are we dealing with here that he would stay true to his covenant people and not really just kind of, you know, clean the slate and start over? Because just reading these from kind of an objective perspective, I would actually kind of be more inclined to say, all right, it's time to call it quits, you know what I mean? Call it a complete loss, wipe them out, pick somebody else, and have Jesus come through that nation instead, right? But God actually continues to be merciful and preserve preserve his people even through this dark, dark time. And so while 17 and 18 would be to sort of express the idolatry that was prevalent in these days, right, as Micah sets up his idol worship, right, and he has his false priest, right, and then the Danites as a whole are kind of, you know, setting up their idol worship, and you just see this widespread idolatry. We can say that 19 through 21 are meant to display the widespread depravity in Israel, right? And we can be sure of this: idolatry leads to depravity. So the two are definitely connected; they're interlinked with one another. Okay, so we're going to see this idolatry. We're going to see how it played out in practical life, and just sort of the depravity that was so common in those days. You're going to notice as we start to read this narrative that the characters are essentially anonymous. They just get referred to kind of by their titles, like the Levite and the Levite's concubine, right? And so I think that this is actually an intentional kind of storytelling device on the part of the author. He's keeping them anonymous because they're supposed to kind of be representative of how it is everywhere. They're kind of supposed to be representative of, like, this is what all the Levites would kind of be like, and this is what all the women would kind of be stuck in this kind of a situation, right? So the widespread exploitation and oppression of women in that time, the widespread selfishness and evil of men, even those men that were from the tribe that were called to be God's priests, right? His mediators and his representatives on the earth. And so those guys would supposedly be kind of like the best of the nation of Israel, if you will, but we're going to actually see them kind of sinking down to be the epitome of selfishness. And then we're even going to see the Benjamites, who also really display some of the most carnal and evil type of behavior imaginable. So we're just going to sadly have to look at this vivid illustration that's kind of indicative of the nation as a whole of anarchy, injustice, and depravity. Okay, so verse 1 of chapter 19 says, "Now it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah." And so right off the bat, the author, he kind of prefaces this entire narrative, right? It's going to be a mess, it's going to be sloppy, but he's going to preface this with, "Now in those days when there was no king in Israel," right? So he's letting us know they're running wild, right? They've rejected the authority of God, of Yahweh, right? And now everyone is doing what is right in their own eyes, right? And so this is in no way at all being endorsed by the Bible, right? What's going to be displayed here is just going to be a vivid picture of sort of that end result of when human evil and human depravity runs wild and everyone just does what seems best to them. And what we see here is that he took him for himself a concubine, right? A concubine. And I don't know, we don't really have that practice in our culture exactly, right? But a concubine is like a second-class wife. Technically, she could even be kind of considered like a slave, okay? Now, God has never approved of this type of union, right? All the way back in Genesis, God instituted marriage, right, between a man and a woman for life, right? And he gave that beautiful gift of marriage, and so now we see a perversion of it in the concubine and almost like master type of relationship, where now you have a guy who essentially has a slave who he somewhat treats like a wife, but ultimately a concubine would agree to this in order to be provided for and protected, okay? Because if you didn't have a husband or some family to take care of you in the ancient Near East, especially in a place like Canaan, you would be subject to all sorts of danger, right? And you wouldn't really have a means of providing yourself. So you would probably end up getting caught up into some form of prostitution. You would probably be exploited in some way. You would probably face imminent death and assault at all times. So it would be kind of an agreement that you would enter into where you would say, all right, well, in return for provision and protection, I'm going to go ahead and be kind of your second-class wife, actually your slave. Now, the man would seek out this kind of relationship primarily for sexual gratification, right? They want the sexual satisfaction that might be found in a marriage relationship, but they still get to kind of dominate over the woman and have that kind of slave master relationship as opposed to the love relationship that God would have in a marriage. Now, while this sounds like a filthy and barbaric practice to us, I think it's interesting if you just look at what each party is getting in this type of a relationship, right? So the woman, she's looking to be protected and provided for, and the man is looking for sexual gratification, okay? Now, I don't think I have to stretch too far. I don't think I have to venture too far away from what we're talking about here. To really kind of bring this and make this a little bit more connected to our culture. And this type of relationship, I think, has a lot of similarities between a boyfriend and a girlfriend living together and cohabitating with each other. Because there's no covenant before God, right? They've made no covenant before God. They're not in any way committed to one another for the duration of their lifespan. And so a woman very well might go move in with her boyfriend with the offer of provision and protection, right? While the boyfriend might very well invite his girlfriend into his apartment or his house for that continual ability to be sexually gratified. I mean, this is not something that we should really look at as being so far removed from just the wickedness of humanity and the way that we take God's good gifts and we corrupt them, we pervert them, and we misuse them and abuse them, right? So right off the bat, we know everything's kind of wrong here, right? This picture is already broken. It's already far away from what God would have. But it says that his concubine goes ahead and she played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah and was there for a period of 4 months. So it's unclear as to why she left, but she got tired of this relationship, right? This almost like a business agreement that they had. And so she goes ahead and seeks out protection and provision in her father's house in Bethlehem. But then her husband, that's the Levite, arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant and a pair of donkeys. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. So it seems like the relationship wasn't completely, you know, broken or anything like that, because her father goes in and invites him in, and everything seems to be pretty much amicable and friendly, right? And now we're just going to read this account, which is kind of weird. It's just essentially an account of excessive hospitality. Like, for whatever reason, this girl's father is just like really glad that the Levite's here, and he's just going to go ahead and just entertain him. Like, that's what he's going to do. He's going to entertain him. And it's going to get to the point where the Levite's going to want to leave, and the father won't let him go. Like, he's like, no, just stay another night. Just eat, drink, be merry with me another night, you know, and you can just stay another night. And so it kind of gets to this point where there's this tension developing, and it's a backward type of tension, right? Because, you know, a lot of times people have, like, house guests and things like that, and they get sick of them, right? I'm sure we've all had house guests that we've grown tired and weary of, but it's actually the house guest who's getting sick of the host in this story, because he's being so overly hospitable. We don't know if he has some kind of like hidden ulterior motive. Maybe he just doesn't want to let his daughter go. I mean, it's hard to say, but so in verse 4, it says his father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. Now on the fourth day, they got up early in the morning, and he prepared to go, and the girl's father said to his son-in-law, sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterward you may go. So both of them sat down and ate and drank together, and the girl's father said to the man, please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry. Then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he spent the night there again. And on the fifth day, he arose to go early in the morning, and the girl's father said, please sustain yourself and wait until the afternoon. So both of them ate And then when the man arose to go along with his concubine and servant, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold now, the day has drawn to a close. Please spend the night. Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here, that your heart may be merry. Then tomorrow you may arise early for your journey, so that you may go home." And so we just see kind of this excessive hospitality, right? He just, like, he wants them to stay. He wants them to eat. He wants them to drink. He wants them to sleep in safety, right? This is really going to stand in sharp contrast to what comes next. But it says he's gotten sick of it. The host, the guest has gotten sick of the host, right? In verse 10 it says, "But the man was not willing to spend the night, so he arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem, and there were with him a pair of saddled donkey. His concubine also was with him." So the father-in-law's efforts to keep the Levite longer have failed, right? He said, enough is enough. I've been here long enough. My mission is to go ahead and get my concubine back, and I've done that, so I'm going to go ahead and take her, and I'm going to go. But the fact that the father-in-law has been trying to detain the Levite is actually going to kind of set the stage for the terrible events that follow, because you'll notice that he said, look, the day is coming to an end, right? It's getting late. And you have to understand that to travel at night is an extremely dangerous type of thing to do in this time, right? Like, I go traveling at night, you know, I turn the headlights on my car, and I drive down the freeway, and, you know, I experience relative safety traveling at night, right? But remember, they're on foot with saddled donkeys, you know what I mean? And they're in a completely kind of corrupted and just depraved land, right, where all sorts of evil and violence could befall them. And so traveling at night's a very dangerous thing, especially trying to find some place to stay the night would also be a very dangerous prospect. They don't have a hotel to check into, right? They have to rely on the hospitality of strangers, okay? And we do have to realize that in the ancient Near East, hospitality was considered to be part of, like, the cultural code. It was considered to be something very important to each person's honor, to be hospitable to those that were passing through, because that was really the only means that you could find places to stay for the night. But we'll see how that all plays out. And it says in verse 11 that when they were near Jebus, the day had almost gone, or was almost gone, and the servant said to his master, "Please come and let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." However, his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel, but we will go as far on as Gibeah." Now, it's ironic here that the Levite is going to go ahead and question the safety of staying in a foreign city, right? He's from Ephraim. He's an Israelite. And he goes, look, I can't really go stay with these Canaanites, because these Canaanites could do something to us, right? We wouldn't be safe staying among Canaanites, so let's just keep going a little bit further so we can enjoy relative safety among men of Israel, right? So verse 13 says, he said to his servant, "Come and let us approach one of these places, and we will spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah." So they passed along and went their way, and the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. 15, they turned aside there in order to enter and lodge in Gibeah. When they entered, they sat in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. Right, so they go, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't go to the Canaanite town, right? Because they won't be kind to us. They won't offer us any hospitality, or maybe they'll even do violence against us. Let's go to our countrymen, right? So he goes to fellow Israelites. Now, admittedly, he's from Ephraim, they're from Benjamin, but still, they roll into the city, and now they're out there in the middle of the city, and no one's going to help them, right? It doesn't look like anyone's going to help them, and this really kind of just illustrates the breakdown, right? The decay of the community, the decay of the nation, right? There was really no unity to speak of among those in Israel at this time. They were all just kind of in it for themselves, their own tribes, right? The tribal allegiance kind of overshadowed their overall allegiance as a chosen nation of God. Now, I don't think that you guys would disagree with me if I told you that this is still a common human problem, right? This is a common problem where our tribal allegiance, if you will, exceeds that. It is greater than that of our allegiance to our position and our place as the people of God, right? There are literally thousands of Christian denominations today, okay? Now, a lot of these, I would say, are merited, because there's a lot of so-called Christian denominations that have actually denied the essentials of the Christian faith and have kind of split off to do their own thing, okay? And so we would never sacrifice truth in the name of unity, right? Because the truth of the gospel is important. It's profoundly unloving to deny the truth of the gospel, because now what you're doing is you're preaching a false gospel in the name of unity, and that's no unity at all. That's just deception and futility, right? So it makes sense that there's definitely been some splits off, you know what I mean? It definitely makes sense that we would have some division there when we take a stand for what matters, right? And that would be the essential doctrines of the Christian faith, right? Things like the Trinity, things like salvation by grace alone through faith alone, things like the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, things like the hypostatic union, Jesus was 100% God and 100% man, right? We don't negotiate on those things. Those are clearly taught in the Bible, and they're essential components, right, to the gospel of Jesus Christ, right? So we need to understand that, okay, yeah, that's fair. However, it is a tragic thing, I think, the lack of unity amongst Christians who are a chosen people, a holy nation called out of darkness into light to proclaim the praises of Jesus who did that for us. It's really tragic when we have our allegiance more to our denomination or our affiliation or our non-denomination than we do to the fact that we are indeed a universal Church of Jesus Christ, right? We are a worldwide body of believers, right? And so we shouldn't neglect that fact. And it's very easy for us to become much more aligned and connected to those that are sort of immediately surrounding us, and then sort of unfairly characterize people that exist outside of our immediate movement or local church, right? There definitely does need to be, I believe, a restoration of unity amongst God's people, just as we see an incredible amount of decay amongst God's people here in the book of Judges, right? So here, to jump back into our text, they really find the exact opposite, right, of the excessive hospitality that he's getting. They find themselves just kind of shunned out in the city square, left to spend the night. But then a foreigner comes into play. Verse 16, then behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah. But the men of the place were Benjamites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, where are you going, and where do you come from? He said to him, we are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, for I am from there. And I went to Bethlehem in Judah, but I am now going to my house, and no man will take me into his house. Yet there is both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and the young man who is with your servants. There is no lack of anything. The old man said, peace to you. Only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square. So he took them into his house and gave the donkeys fodder, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. And so we see the old man from Ephraim, right? He finally comes in and kind of saves the day, if you will, right? He gives them a place to stay. But remember, it seems like the only reason he could possibly be doing this is, well, they're from the same area too, right? So they're kind of, it's people sticking together from Ephraim here. And he even says, like, I have all the food that I need for my animals and for the people that are with me. So all I'm asking for is a roof over my head, right? I'm not asking for any food or provision, right? I have it all taken care of. But even though he had it all taken care of, that didn't change the fact that nobody actually wanted to take him in. And we see in the land of Benjamin, in this Benjamite city, it actually takes a foreign residence, right? Somebody that's just working there temporarily to extend any sort of help. Verse 22 says, while they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city certain worthless fellows surrounded the house, pounding the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came into your house that we may have relations with him. When they say that, they say that doesn't mean bring him out so that we can get to know him. You know, bring him out so we can take him out for a beer and you know, hear what he's about, you know, become his buddy. Like, sorry we missed our opportunity to be hospitable to you in the city square. Like, we want to make amends. We want to get to know you as a friend. No, that means that they actually want to engage in the act of homosexual rape. That's what they're interested in doing. So that's why they're pounding on the door. Now, when it says here that it was certain worthless fellows that surrounded the house, the worthless fellows there are literally would be the sons of Belial, right? So the sons of Belial, they actually surround the house and they pound on it to perpetrate this rape, right? That's what they're interested in. Now, Belial is actually a word that has become synonymous with Satan. Believe it or not, Belial has become synonymous with Satan. You might remember 2 Corinthians 6:14-15. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness, and what communion has light with darkness, and what accord has Christ with Belial, or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? Okay? So there are actually three possible word origins for Belial in Hebrew. It's kind of like a word that's very ancient. But essentially, the beginning of that word, Beli, means not, okay? And then the three possible origins would come from Beli, not, over, Yal, which means essentially not over. In other words, I won't have anyone over me. So that's kind of the expression of pride. The other possible origin would be not yoke, Belial, which means like I refuse to be governed, like a lawlessness. Or this one is probably the one that people tend to lean more towards, our translation here calling them worthless fellows, would say not profitable. So Belial, which means like unprofitable, right? And we know that those that would devote themselves entirely to exploitation, depravity, and evil would definitely be those that we could classify as unprofitable, right? Or worthless fellows. Now, we know that these are all apt descriptions of Satan, right? Satan is unprofitable. He is lawless. He is prideful, right? So it's no surprise that Hebrews throughout history would often connect Belial with Satan, right? In 1 John 5:19, it says, we know that we are of God and that the whole world lies under the power of the evil one, right? That's Satan. So there really are, ultimately, there's only two families in this world, believe it or not. There's those that are of God and those that are of Satan. There's a family of God and there's a family of Satan. And now to make such a stark distinction is something that's very offensive, right? But we have to understand, first off, the only reason that we're of God is because of the saving work of Jesus, right? Like, we didn't deserve to become God's people, right? In fact, we all walked in that exact same type of depravity. We all walked in sin. We walked running, or even not even walking, running towards death, right? As those that served and lived under the authority and the dominion of Satan up until that point when God, by his grace, broke in and rescued us, right? By that forgiveness that's found in Christ. But that really is the reality. So these men approaching them, they might be some of those prime examples of the sons of Satan, but the reality is, apart from Christ, everyone lies under his sway. Everyone lies enslaved to their own carnal desires and sins, right? So now 23, it says that the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not commit this act of folly. And so what's at play here is the old man from Ephraim, he wants to keep his honor intact. Okay, he wants to keep his honor intact. And the way that he would do that is he would defend his male guest. He's extended hospitality to a male guest. And so he just has to make sure that that person is cared for and catered to and protected. And then he can basically say that he has his honor intact and his status has not been degraded at all. So in order to keep his honor intact in a cultural sense, he's going to go ahead and say, here's my virgin daughter in verse 24, and his, that is the Levite's concubine, please let me bring them out that you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish, but do not commit such an act of folly against this man. So he completely disregards any sort of love or care that he would have for his own daughter, and then he completely disregards this other woman who is the concubine of the Levite being kind of forcibly brought back from her father's house, right, because she's run away from her master, and he really is only concerned about the well-being of the Levite. That's where his concern lies. Now, verse 25 says, but the men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them, and they raped her and abused her all night until morning and let her go at the approach of dawn. And so the man there, that's not the old man from Ephraim. That's the Levite. So now the Levite, right, he's on the line, right? Like he's in trouble here. Like there's a mob of people out there that are looking to assault him. And the only way that he sees that he might be able to get out of this predicament is to go ahead and take his concubine and throw her out to these sons of Belial, right? These worthless fellows, these sons of Satan. So he sort of just throws her to the dogs and leaves her out there to sort of be the person that protects him by being victimized by these evil men. 26 says that as the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until full daylight. Now, this narrative is meant to be shocking, okay? This narrative is meant to be appalling. It's also meant to be very similar to another narrative. It's supposed to have a lot of literary qualities that directly tie in. Like, we should be like, if you've been reading your Bible chronologically, you should read this account and say, I've read something just like this somewhere else, right? And that would be found in Genesis chapter 19. Now, the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. And he said, now, behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night, and wash your feet, that you may rise early and go on your way. They said, however, no, but we shall spend the night in the square. Yet he urged them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter, and they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we may have relations with them. But Lot went out to them at the doorway and shut the door behind him and said, please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have had not relations with men. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like. Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch they have come under the shelter of my roof. But they said, stand aside. Furthermore, they said, this one came in as an alien and already is acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them. So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to breaking the door. But the men reached out with their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great. So they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. So there's an intentional similarity between the two stories here, right? You can see, like, point by point, it almost goes exactly the same, right? The men enter the city, the guy implores them not to stay in the city square, invites them in, shows them hospitality, the mob comes to rape the men, he offers women instead because his honor's at stake, except for the fact that that Lot's guests were angels, right? So they're able to reach out and strike the mob with blindness. In this instance, now you have the Levite, this cowardly Levite, right, who's able to go ahead and just throw his concubine out to actually have assaulted. Now, the reason that I believe that these two accounts are so close to one another is because we're supposed to realize that Gibeah, in the land of the Benjamites, right? So this is Israel. This is God's chosen covenant people, the Benjamites. But Gibeah is just like Sodom, right? So now Gibeah has become Sodom 2.0, right? That they're just like them. And so this is supposed to illustrate the kind of corruption and depravity that's taking place in Israel. A city that God would utterly destroy with fire is just the same. It's just like Gibeah in the land of the Benjamites. 27. When her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, then behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. So you imagine she was reaching out for help, right? She was crawling back. She was reaching out for help, and she's holding on, but no one has let her in. And he said to her, "Get up and let us go." But there was no answer. So we can probably say that at this point she has died over the course of the night. And so then he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and went to his home. Now, this introduces some very troubling questions, right? Because it says that he was celebrating, right? That he was in there kind of enjoying himself, eating and drinking with his host. So after he throws his concubine out to them, does he just go back to doing that? Does he soundly sleep through the night? What does he do? Well, he just seems to comfortably stay the night in this man's house. And then when he comes out to find his concubine dead, he's not really concerned about her well-being at all, right? Her terrible state. He just says, "Get up and let us go." Like, that's all he has to really say. So there's no compassion. There's no care. There's no love, right? This is simply the other side of a contract that he had, right? She was supposed to be given provision and protection in return for his sexual gratification. But it turns out when it comes to it, he won't even provide her with protection, right? He'll go ahead and he'll throw her out just so that he himself can be protected. And his host would gladly endorse such behavior because of the fact that he would be more concerned about his honor entertaining a male guest than he would about the well-being of women. Now, 29 says that when he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine and cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. All who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the days when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up." Wow. So the nation has rejected God, right? Everyone does what is right in their own eyes. And so we see this horrific, right, this graphic illustration of depravity, which demonstrates just how repulsive sin is, right? This little piece at the end here, what he's basically doing is he's stirring up people. He's inciting the rest of the people to get revenge, right? He wants vengeance. But it doesn't really seem like he had any care for the concubine herself, right? He's probably just more upset that his property has been destroyed, right? That's probably what he's probably more upset that somebody would try to come and assault him, and so he wants to exact vengeance upon them. So the way that he does that is he goes ahead and he sends pieces of his concubine all throughout and says, "Look what they've done to her." And now it's going to rile everybody up and sort of stir everybody up to do something, right? But, you know, we could probably talk for a really long time about everything that's wrong here, right? But what we do see here is we see men that are dehumanizing, devaluing, and assaulting women, right? I think about what the actual biblical prescription is as far as when it comes to how us as men are to relate to women, right? I would think first thing in my mind would probably be actually 1 Peter 3:7, right, which talks about how husbands would relate to their wives, right, not masters to their concubines, right, definitely not something approved in the Bible. It says, "Husbands, likewise dwell with them, that your wives with all understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered." Now, there's been a lot of things said about women being the weaker vessel, right? If you get into an argument with a girl and she starts crying, you go, "Oh, you're just the weaker vessel," right? You dismiss them. That's actually not a good interpretation of this text. I spent a good amount of time studying the book of 1 Peter when I taught through it at one point in time. And really, the only thing that you can say with absolute certainty about this text, what it's teaching, is that in general, women are weaker than men physically. Like, that's literally what you can say. And some people will do conjecture like, well, Eve was deceived in the garden, you know what I mean? And so she's more, you know, they're more prone to being deceived. Maybe you can make that argument from Genesis, but you can't make that argument from 1 Peter. Just the plain reading of the text, the plainest reading of the text, is that women are generally physically weaker than men. Okay, so we'll kind of just get that out of the way. You also see in this exact same text that the Bible teaches that women are equal in value and dignity to men, right? Because what does it say? It says, you're heirs together of the grace of life. Another way of putting that, you're co-heirs of the grace of life. That means that you guys actually have an equal share, right? You're heirs together. You're on equal footing when it comes to the grace of God and the grace of life. So, in general, women are weaker physically than men. This is true. I know for a fact that there are women that could kick the tar out of me, right? I've seen them, right? There's those, oh man, there's women that fight, you know what I mean? There's probably women that just grew up in more rough parts of the world that could just take me to school, right? And just tear me up. But in general, as a general principle, they would be weaker than men. So men are to use their physical advantage to protect and sacrificially serve women, right? Male headship becomes an occasion for service, not brute exercise of power. So we see that it would be evil, for us to use our advantage for exploitation, right? It'd be evil for us to use our advantage for exploitation. And I think that a good mark, one of those kind of litmus tests that we have for the depravity of a society, is how it treats the vulnerable. When we see how a society treats the vulnerable. Because if I go walk over to Trent right now and I deck him in the face, there's probably going to be some kind of a consequence to that. You know what I mean? There might be some kind of a physical altercation, because Trent can probably defend himself to an extent. So the real question is, what will I do when I'm confronted with somebody who has no ability to defend themselves? When I'm confronted with somebody who has no ability to protect themselves, to look out for themselves, they're really just completely at my mercy, right? Then we get to see the true test. Because right now, what could restrain me, it wouldn't necessarily have to be any sort of morality. It wouldn't have to be any sort of awareness of God. It wouldn't have to be any sort of work of the Lord in my life. I could literally be restrained from evil just by the consequence of what might happen to me if I were to exact some sort of exploitation or violence, right? We have laws in place, right? And some of those laws would possibly get me in trouble if I do an act of violence against, you know, certain people, or even if I just steal from people or exploit people in any way, right? We have these consequences in place, which would kind of restrain us. But what happens when there's just the vulnerable, right? What happens when there's just the vulnerable and there's nothing that they can do to protect themselves? That's the real mark, right? Because now it seems that I can actually do what I would wish to do, and I can do it apparently consequence-free. Now, we as Christians, we know that there's no such thing as a sin without consequence, right? And we know that the wrath of God burns against those that would exploit those who are vulnerable and would use and assault those who have no means of defending themselves. And we know that there will be a perfect judgment, right? And there will be a perfect settling of the score, if you will. And it's ultimately going to be perfectly settled at the cross of Christ or in hell. Like, it's going to happen. Judgment is going to be executed for all of these things, including what we just read about in this story. So I think, you know, when we think about just some of those ways that a society can be measured, its depravity by the way. Yeah.
Do you think there'll be specifically a special place in hell for people like this?
Like levels of hell?
I know there's a lot of, like, I talk to some people, they think, like, oh no, like, all sin is equal, so therefore, there's just, like, everyone's just going to be in one area of hell. And I also heard people, like, oh no, like, there's going to be special places, people like Hitler, on people like that? Like, seriously, though.
The Bible doesn't say a whole lot about hell. It doesn't teach much about hell. I would have to say that I really have no idea. I do know that God does deal in justice, and his justice does seem, like, the punishment does seem to fit the crime. If you really look at the way that God has dispensed his justice throughout history. So I could say that God will execute justice in hell, and he will dispense that with a perfect equity, and with, like, perfectly in proportion. But I also have to say that the only reason that people go to hell is because they ultimately, in our days, they rejected Jesus, and it, before Christ, because they rejected the Lord. The condemnation of humanity, if you will, is that you look and it's clearly visible to you that there is a creator, right? And he's made it well known to you that you are not right with him, right? You know for a fact that you're not in good standing with him, and then you go ahead and you reject him and just disregard him for what immediately surrounds you.
Because I think, well, in my head, I process it kind of like, I mean, we don't go to heaven based on our works, we don't. But when we do get to heaven by believing in God and, you know, acknowledging that we are sinners, we do get rewarded crowns for our works in heaven, like on earth.
Mm-hmm.
So in my head, why would hell be any different to where, I'm not saying that, yeah, there is hell, but I'm just trying to process it. Why would hell be any different of people who have rejected God and, hey, you're already in hell? Now you're based upon your works that you've done on earth. Now here's this different punishment. Don't we see something like reading where Satan is going to be thrown in like the lake of fire?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I mean, how do we know if that's not a different? I don't know. It's just something that I was just thinking about.
It's hard. It's hard, really, to build a biblical picture of hell just because of the fact that there's limited things that are said about it. So to kind of get the specifics and the details. I do know for a fact that for people created in the image of God and designed for eternal fellowship with him, that the worst possible punishment, the greatest possible punishment imaginable would be eternal separation from God, and that the greatest possible reward imaginable would be eternal fellowship with God. And so you can kind of talk about, you know, the degrees of punishment or the variety of rewards. But ultimately, the greatest reward for any believer will be fellowship with the Lord. And the greatest punishment for anyone who rejects him would be eternal separation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to throw in something, and that's the separation. It's awareness.
Yeah.
That's the fourth road. If you look at the story that Jesus talked about, Lazarus.
Yeah.
I mean, he was aware that he was suffering. The rich ruler or whatever.
True.
He was suffering, but he was also aware that there was a separation and that Lazarus was comforted and he was not. So I think that's going to be the horrible thing for whoever ends up in hell. I don't know. I don't want to know. I'd rather concentrate on the other stuff. I'd rather know about heaven than worry yeah. about hell from that standpoint. But they're going to be suffering in a horrible way and be aware of their separation from God and aware of all of that. It's worse than just getting thrown in the corner, so to speak. I
don't know. So I think that we can read a story like this, right? And we can see these men, right, driven by their lust, by their carnal desires, exploit and abuse this poor woman, right? And we see that, and I don't think it's a stretch for us to say that we think that that's disgusting, right? And we look at it and we think this is terrible. And ultimately, you know, you read something like this and you kind of just feel a little bit of disgust, a little bit of anger, right? You're just like, how could something like this happen? Like, this is so obscene, right? But I just want to kind of put it in a little bit of perspective for us here tonight. And, you know, the reality is that we still have this kind of, you know, exploitation taking place today. We still have different women, but also men and boys and girls that are still exploited to this day. You know what I mean? Sexual trafficking is still a huge issue. It's a multi-billion dollar industry that is prevalent even in our own nation. In fact, you would think like, oh, the drug lords, right? The drug lords are the ones making the money. No, the human trafficking lords, if you will, the ones over that are the ones that are making the money. They dwarf the illegal drug trade in their profits and how prevalent this is. And now to actually put it even a little bit more into perspective, just even in the consumption of pornography, chances are you have actually supported human trafficking financially with the consumption of pornography, because you watch any amount of pornography, odds are you're actually contributing ad revenue to somebody that has taken a woman and has abused her and exploited her and then put her on display for your own and anyone else who might consume that pornography, their sexual gratification. And so we look at these men, right, and they're taking this woman, they're raping her, and they're assaulting her, and they're using her for their sexual gratification. And we think, oh, how awful, how obscene, how disgusting. But the reality is human trafficking is still a major reality in our world. And, statistically speaking, most people in the Christian church have actually supported human trafficking, and they've done it for the gratification of their own sexual lusts. And so when you think about that for a moment, and you just kind of let that reality sink in and sort of weigh heavy on you, now I have to just ask, you know, isn't sin disgusting? Isn't sin disgusting? And I think that Thomas Watson, old Puritan, said it best. He says, until sin is bitter, Christ will not be sweet. Until we really just sink in, and we let it sink in just how horrific and disgusting sin is, especially sin that would exploit and use and assault the vulnerable. When we start to think about that, it really should become something that is heart-wrenching for us, and it should become something that is very bitter. Because as long as we harbor and we hold on to any sort of love for sin or provision for sin in our lives, until we don't burn with hatred towards sin, we've actually kind of compromised our ability to revel and to enjoy and to experience the abundance of life that Christ has bought for us with his own death and his own blood. And I think that we often have a tendency to trivialize sin. We have a tendency to trivialize sin. And that's because of how complete and perfect Jesus' work was, right? He's covered our sins. We are completely forgiven of all our sins, past, present, and future, because when he said it's finished, he meant it, right? And so Jesus so perfectly absorbed the wrath of God for sin, and he so graciously saved us to the uttermost from our sins, that I think that sometimes we can start to trivialize sin and be like, oh, well, you know, Jesus took care of that. Like, I'm forgiven. But just take a moment. Just because Jesus did that, just because Jesus bore our shame and bore our punishment, does not mean that sin is no longer disgusting and repulsive. It still is, right? And so this story just serves as an illustration of what happens when people do what is right in their own eyes, when the lordship and the authority of our Creator God is rejected and exchanged for us doing whatever seems right to us, whatever seems most pleasurable to us, whatever seems to be just what we would do if we were in control of our own lives, masters of our own destiny. And how foolish is that to approach and even be mindful of the God of the universe and then say, oh, don't worry, I got this. I can figure this out on my own. I know what I'm supposed to be doing, right? It's madness. It's futility. It's depravity. And it's horrific. So let's go ahead and take a break.